Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The House on Tuesday voted to raise the U.S. borrowing limit into December, putting off the tougher job of setting a new ceiling so that the federal government can pay its bills beyond that date. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he won't help Democrats raise the debt ceiling again. President Biden said that failure to follow through threatens America's reputation on the world stage. New York Times reporter Emily Cochran has been covering the story. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
The House passed a bill to raise the debt ceiling yesterday, but the real breakthrough came last week when the deal was struck in the Senate to move that legislation to the House. How did the Senate deal come together? What happened?
So, as you mentioned, there's been sort of an impasse over addressing the debt limit. It's become this proxy fight for this massive domestic policy package Democrats are trying to push through over unanimous Republican opposition. Republicans, up until last week, had said, you know, because you want to do this level of spending without our input, we're not going to give you help on this must-pass legislation. Senator Mitch McConnell, however, last week decided to change a little bit, made a tactical move to agree to give the votes needed to overcome a Republican filibuster. Just 10 Republicans are needed to join all Democrats in the Senate to advance most legislation. So he got those votes together. They cleared the filibuster, and then only Democrats voted in favor of raising the debt limit. That being said, less than a day later, Leader McConnell said that he would not make that sort of concession again. And that sets us up for yet another cliff, so to speak, come at least early December.
He won't make that concession again unless they start talking turkey about these infrastructure and social safety net bills.
Absolutely. But for Democrats, that's their marquee legislation. That is the biggest piece of both President Biden's agenda and their legislative ambitions, which they believe delivered them the majorities in both the House and the Senate. So there's very little chance that Democrats would even consider dropping any part of that bill.
We're talking about the issue over the debt limit in Congress right now. My guest is Emily Cochran. She is a reporter for the New York Times. If you have a question or comment coming up this hour about this, we're going to get into the politics of it. We're going to get into the economics of it. We have economist and a political scientist joining us. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. All right. But I've been reading that Speaker Pelosi is starting to think about making changes to the bill, lowering the price tag on it. Am I missing something there?
No, that is true. But that's more a reflection of the sort of intra-party realities of needing almost every Democrat on board. Even if they lower it, which we, as you said, we expect them to do, it'll be lower than the original $3.5 trillion price tag they set on. Even if it's lower, for Republicans, it's still far too much spending towards policies they cannot support. So it really seems to be a matter of they drop the package altogether, and then they will be willing to come to the table. I think it's worth noting that the minority party generally offers some sort of political opposition to the debt ceiling. But this is sort of a brinkmanship that we haven't really seen before, and the idea that Republicans won't even get out of the procedural way to help clear this legislation, knowing what the economic consequences could be.
Now, for people who keep track, this has been going on since the 90s, and I'm going to talk about the deeper politics of this. But Republicans have voted in recent years, particularly, I think, three times during the last administration, to increase the debt limit, right?
Yes, and that's the Democratic argument, that they should not have to bear the burden of the debt ceiling alone when, under the Trump administration, Democrats helped suspend it and address it. And under previous Democratic administrations, Republicans did the same thing. This is debt that has been incurred and approved by both parties, under administrations of both parties, and Democrats are really pushing back on the suggestion that they should do it alone.
And another thing is this is not like government shutting down. This is government not paying its bills. This is a flow of cash that's worldwide, right?
Correct. I mean, it obviously, as you said, when the government shuts down, that is devastating for federal employees and the government's ability to function. But should the Treasury Department run against this limit and no longer be able to borrow money, you know, that's catastrophic for the full faith and credit of the United States and how we are how our credit is seen abroad. It could result in some tough decisions in terms of paying interest on the loans, on the debt that the country has already racked up, and getting out Social Security payments and getting out food assistance and things that the federal government needs to do. You could see a delay in those payments, and it could spiral very, very quickly.
And the Tuesday vote was a short-term extension, meaning they did raise the debt ceiling, but only just enough to get them another 6 weeks out, right?
Yes, they raised the cap by about $480 billion, which the Treasury Department estimates will take us to at least December 3rd. There are some estimates out there that suggest there could be an additional couple weeks for the government to figure out the next solution. Democrats had originally wanted to suspend the debt ceiling until the end of 2022, but that would have required Republican votes. So come at least early December, Congress will have to not only confront how to keep the government open, but also how to address the debt ceiling.
Where does the power to suspend the debt ceiling come from? What's the machinations of that?
So the idea of suspending it towards a date means that it sort of is a catch-all for the spending, as opposed to voting for a specific number as they did on Tuesday, because that is just a little more politically charged in terms of people. You'll likely see ads saying, you know, this particular lawmaker voted to add to the debt by X amount, as opposed to just sort of this generic, we're just going to put it off until a certain date, which is what they've done in the past. So that is part of the crux of the issue. Republicans do also want to sort of have Democrats on the record behind a specific number.
Is Mitch McConnell right that Democrats would be blamed if the U.S. defaulted in this way, which is, it's never been done before, right?
No, that it would be the first time that the American government had ever defaulted on its debt, which is part of the concern that you've heard from President Biden and other officials. I think there's something to be said for the argument that Democrats are in control of both the Senate, the House, and the White House. And the average American is going to see Democrats in control of all those three parts of government and say, well, why couldn't you work it out? That being said, with the filibuster in place in the Senate, Republican, you need that 60 vote threshold. They need Republican votes to do this through the normal channels as they have in the past.
And the filibuster requires a higher number of votes for something, and eliminating the filibuster would go to a straight majority vote, a simple majority,
correct,
I should say. What about that? Have Democrats talked? I mean, is there any way? I guess you'd need the Republican support for that as well.
You would need the support of every Senate Democrat, all 50 Democrats, to get rid of the filibuster. And while Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have been long holdouts against getting rid of the filibuster and have given no indication that the debt ceiling could be the issue to change their mind, there was some momentum last week where you saw senators who had normally been reluctant to openly talk about the idea really starting to coalesce around the idea that maybe this is the issue that would bring the caucus together to eliminate the filibuster. And I do think that's part of the reason why you saw Mitch McConnell and 10 other Republicans sort of temporarily drop the blockade of the debt ceiling legislation and agree to just a procedural maneuver to advance this bill, because that they are so concerned about this 60 vote threshold going away and it becoming a simple majority body.
I also read somewhere that this is a way to tie up Democrats in the meantime as well from doing anything else, from working on the infrastructure and the social safety net bills in more detail.
Certainly now that they've They passed this stopgap bill yesterday. We expect President Biden to sign it as early as today. Certainly, they now have a lot more time to sort of figure out these intra-party issues over this much broader policy bill that's not, you know, that carries their ambitions, but is not a must-pass government bill.
What are your expectations come December when this expires again?
I think we will face the same sort of impasse and brinkmanship that we've seen for the last couple of weeks. And there's no real indication yet as to how Democrats plan to resolve this. For a lot of the party, Republicans should not be taking the stand. They feel that it's incredibly dangerous to play around with the full faith and credit of the country. And the fact that 11 Republicans did help with this procedural step last week for Democrats is evidence that they are willing to take this step and are willing to help shoulder the legislative burden of getting this into law. So it's going to be a tough few weeks on Capitol Hill.
So that 10 Senate Republicans that voted for it moving forward, that wasn't people ordered by Mitch McConnell to vote for it. That was people Mitch McConnell was letting vote their conscience.
I think it was a combination of both. Okay. If you look at, so it was Senator Mitch McConnell and it was 10 other Republicans. If you look at those 10 other Republicans, it is lawmakers who are retiring. It is moderates who are typically in support of bipartisan solution and working through this process, and allies of leadership, allies of Senator McConnell. So I think it was a combination of people who were more likely to support this sort of solution in the case of moderates, but also some very real allies of Leader McConnell.
Well, Emily Cochran, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Emily Cochran is a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. We've been talking about kind of the brinksmanship behind what's going on in Congress over the issue of the debt ceiling. The House voted yesterday to extend the debt to increase it enough to get the government by for 6 more weeks paying its bills. But at this point, there doesn't seem to be any place where they can come to a meeting of the minds. We are going to get into the politics of this. We're going to dig deeper into what the economics of it are, what it means to the world, what it means to the United States, what it means to individual taxpayers and people who depend on the government for things like Social Security, food stamps, that kind of a thing. So if you have a question or comment, this is the time to give it a call. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Political brinksmanship around the basic functions of government is now a fact of life in the U.S. That's exemplified by the frequency and duration of government shutdowns. But the debt limit, which empowers the government to borrow to pay its debt, is another story altogether. President Biden last week put it this way.
Defaulting on the debt would lead to a self-inflicted wound that takes our economy over a cliff and risks jobs and retirement savings, Social Security benefits, salaries for service members, benefits for veterans, and so much more.
Joining us, Paul Beck. He's a political scientist and professor emeritus at Ohio State University. Welcome back, Paul.
Good to see you, Ann.
And Richard Silla is an economist and professor emeritus at the New York University Stern School of Business. For 25 years until 2015, he was the Henry Kaufman Professor of the History of Financial Institutions and Markets. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you. Greetings from New Hampshire.
Richard Silla, why is there a debt ceiling? Why do we have it? Because not every country does.
That's right. I think we're one of two countries. The other one might be Denmark. We have a debt ceiling because since World War I, Congress delegated its control over debt issuing to the Treasury to manage From the beginning of the country, say in 1790 to World War I, every increase in debt was legislated by Congress directly. World War I led to a lot of debt issues, and so Congress decided to delegate the authority to manage the debt to the Treasury, but it wanted to put a little control on it, so it brought in the debt ceiling. You know, you have the authority to borrow this money on our behalf up to a certain limit. And so it came in during World War I, and so it's been, there have been changes in the debt ceiling nearly 100 times, I think, since the 1940s.
Right. I mean, it's pretty common. It's pretty perfunctory, but it's been politicized. Paul Beck, when did the politicization of it kick off?
Well, it really goes back a long time. I think the architect of this kind of partisan politicization was probably Newt Gingrich back when he first joined the House of Representatives in the 1980s. And Representative Gingrich at the time, this was before he was Speaker, argued to his Republican colleagues, if we were ever going to be in the majority in the House, and they hadn't been in the majority for decades, Gingrich argued to them, we need to make sure we try to embarrass the Democrats on everything. And the debt ceiling became one of that basket of things that they could embarrass the Democrats with and force the Democrats to increase the debt ceiling, which meant take on and finance more debt.
Has it cut both ways? I mean, have Democrats used the debt ceiling to torture Republicans?
Well, it's almost inevitable that when one side begins to do something, the other side wants to do a tit-for-tat exchange there. And so there's been some of that on the Democratic side, although it's notable that during the Trump years, the Democrats did indeed vote to increase the debt ceiling. Maybe the other thing to consider here is that the Democrats tend to be the party that is more supportive of government spending, whereas the Republicans, except in the national defense area, have been reluctant to increase government spending. And so in some ways, expanding the debt ceiling is something Democrats are going to want to do, and something that Republicans philosophically perhaps want to oppose. But again, I don't want to push that too hard. I think this is a good example of partisan polarization and partisan warfare meant to score points, that the debt ceiling will be raised, certainly not now, but in December, probably, because the risk of catastrophe, if it's not raised, is pretty serious.
Richard Cilla, back when they established the debt ceiling with the caveat that Congress had to approve it, were they worried about politics back then?
I don't think so. I think the main concern when the debt ceiling came in World War I was that there was just too much debt having to be issued to prosecute the war to have Congress involved in every particular debt issue. So we had the Liberty bond drives and the Victory bond drives, and the Treasury managed those, and Congress you didn't want to be involved in the nitty-gritty of debt issues and management. So it delegated that to the Treasury, but it wanted to have some control. And so they told the Treasury, you can have the authority to increase the debt, but we put a ceiling on it. And if you want to go above that, you have to come back and deal with us.
And I just want to dare I go into the weeds here just a little bit, Richard Cilla, and can you explain what happens? All right, so we're in debt for, however you can explain it so mere mortals can understand it. We're in debt. We need the debt ceiling raised so we can go into more debt to pay more bills. What happens at that point when the debt ceiling is raised? What then does the Treasury Department do?
Well, the Treasury then can issue the bonds. I think it's important for our listeners to realize that the authority, to spend the money was already created by Congress. And so in some sense, one of the problems with the debt ceiling debates that we have is that, Congress is basically saying we authorized this sort of spending, but now we're telling you that you can't fund it because you're up against a debt ceiling. And that's one of the really odd things about it. It's not the sort of blank check for the government to borrow whatever it wants. The debt ceiling actually prevents the Treasury from financing what Congress has already authorized to be spent. And that's one of the peculiarities of it. It's like we authorize this spending, but now we're not going to let you raise the money to spend that money.
Right. I mean, that exactly. I mean, and isn't it implicit that if they've already approved the spending of for whatever program it might be, is there an argument to be made that the Treasury could just go ahead and issue the bonds anyways?
Well, it can't do it with the debt ceiling, but you know, it's been proposed. A congressman back in the 1980s, Richard Gephardt, who's from Missouri, he actually proposed that we the law be changed to say whenever Congress decides to authorize the spending some money, it implicitly is authorizing the Treasury to borrow that money. That would be a right way around the debt ceiling. But Congressman Gephardt wasn't successful in that. More recently, economist Alan Blinder, who used to be the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, said we should bring in Gephardt's rule, revitalize it, and that could be a solution to this problem. But so far, nobody has actually called for doing that in Congress.
Well, I mean, wouldn't that just kick the can down? I mean, wouldn't it just be politicized at that level now at this point in the game?
Well, I think if it was implicit in the decision of Congress to authorize spending on something, that if it was implicit that that meant the Treasury could borrow the money to do it, that would be a way around the debt ceiling. Not necessarily a good thing. I mean, I think the debt ceiling does serve a function. I just wish it weren't so partisan.
And would that then be something that the Supreme Court would decide?
Well, if Congress adopted Gephardt's rule, I think the Supreme Court wouldn't have to be involved. It would just mean that whenever Congress authorized spending on something, it implicitly authorized the Treasury to finance it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the debt ceiling today. Yesterday, the House voted to extend it approximately another 6 weeks, meaning they raised the debt ceiling just enough to get them to December. But then the political brinksmanship, comes into the fore again. And the question is whether Republicans will go with Democrats or whether Democrats will go with Republicans in either backing down on more spending, which is a big priority for Democrats right now, or Republicans will even go with something modified when it comes to the infrastructure and the social safety net bills that are pending. If you have a question or comment about the debt limit, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. With us today is Paul Beck. He's a political scientist and professor emeritus at Ohio State, and also Richard Silla, an economist and professor emeritus at the New York University Stern School of Business. So, Richard Silla, if the U.S. stops paying its bills, what's the chain of events? Why this apocalyptic scenario ahead of us?
Well, the U.S. Treasury debt market is the largest market in the history of the world in the issues of a single issuer. And the U.S. debt plays a role not only in our country, but around the world. It's considered to be the safest asset. And we see that whenever there's turmoil in the financial markets, we find that people sell their stocks and corporate bonds and move the money into U.S. Treasury debt because it's considered to be a safe haven. And so our national debt plays a very large role in the operation of financial markets all over the world. And if somehow the prime credit of the United States is threatened by a debt ceiling that leads to a government shutdown or the Treasury can't pay the interest on the debt, that we're going to lose the confidence of the world that has been built up over our entire history. They say we've never defaulted on our debt, and that's more or less true. That's why the world rushes into the U.S. national debt when it's worried about everything else. And we don't want to lose that prime credit. In 2011, the last time the debt ceiling led to a government shutdown, the S&P, the raters of corporate and debt and all debt, downgraded the U.S. from a AAA rating to a AA rating. The other agencies didn't do that. Moody's and Fitch didn't do that. But that was a kind of warning of what could happen. Now, we solved that problem in 2011 and everything's operated normally, but we're skating on thin ice whenever we threaten to undermine the credit of the U.S. government.
Right. And even coming this close to a threat to ending the credit of the U.S. government, does that create some level of turmoil anyways, or does it actually have to go to the, you know, fall off the cliff first?
Well, I think financial markets will react. This time, I think the financial markets didn't react very much, although there was a little bit of a downdraft in the markets in September. But I think they were confident that some kind of deal would be reached. And in fact, it has been reached, but we only kicked the can down the road, what, 6 or 7 weeks?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so back in the holiday season in December, we may be facing this problem again.
Yeah, happy holidays. So, Paul Beck, we kind of frame this often in just in terms of Democrats versus Republicans, kind of a domestic political issue, but it is an international political issue, really, isn't it? I mean, when it gets to this point, it's not just domestic interests at play then, right?
Oh, I think that's right. And in fact, there are two broad categories of holders of our debt. One is other countries. And of course, if it roils those markets, you could imagine, let's say, China, who has become probably the enemy of choice in American domestic politics. China could say simply, we're going to unload our debt. We're not going to cope with this. And that would present us with a real serious problem. The other problem is that most of the debt is held in the United States. For example, the Social Security Trust Fund is borrowed against to cover some of the debt. And if the United States were to renege and, you know, fail to pay interest on that, all of a sudden Social Security funds are not going to last as long when it comes to people drawing upon them for their retirement. And this is true of other pension benefits as well. I belong to the state teachers retirement system that is invested also in federal government debt. And if they were to, the federal government, that is, were to renege on that debt, then all of a sudden my pension benefits could be jeopardized.
I have an email from George in Columbus. He writes, is it true that if the debt ceiling is not raised, that the remaining federal obligations will be paid out in order required by law, that is, debt service, Social Security, Medicare, veterans obligations will be paid first, then all other obligations? Richard Cilla, is that how it works?
I think there is a pecking order of priorities, and the national debt is always at the top of the list. The problem is if the Treasury, can't borrow the money it needs to meet its obligations, it's basically in default. And that's what we want to avoid. Now, the Treasury has some ways, there's something called the, Exchange Stabilization Fund that's available. It's been used in the past when Congress wouldn't authorize spending in the 1990s when Mexico had financial problems. They used this Exchange Stabilization Fund to finance some government spending. So there are some ways to, gain an extra week or two. But I think the number one priority is to pay the interest on the debt, which we've done for 230 years without fail. And if we didn't do that, the world would be in something of a financial panic.
Why, when I hear about the threat of all of this, do they talk about generations will be impacted? Richard Cilla, isn't it something you could just let's say they don't increase the debt limit by that deadline day, but a week later they do. What's the damage done in a week?
Well, I think the, financial markets will react very negatively. But look, the debt is really large. I think people ought to be reminded. I'm an old timer, so I remember this, and maybe Paul does too. The national debt of the United States was $1 trillion in 1980. It first got up to $1 trillion in 1980. That's not that long ago, four decades ago. Today, it's $28 trillion. So we got through 190 years of U.S. history to take the debt up to $1 trillion. And in the last 40, 41 years, we've gone up to $28 trillion. And so this is really a huge financial asset in the world. And if it's threatened with a default, I think the consequences are really pretty serious for all of us. Paul mentioned Social Security and his pension. If they don't have the money to pay us, in 1 week, people might stop receiving Social Security checks.
Mm-hmm. And that becomes a direct pocketbook issue to everyday Americans then.
Right. And, that money gets spent on people's necessities. And so it's really a threat. That's why it's hard to realize that why Congress turns this into a political football game.
Because it can, Paul Beck?
Yes, because it can. And I think there's also a feeling on the part of most members of Congress that this is going to get resolved. But it's brinksmanship. They go right up to the brink before they resolve it. And nobody is probably happy about resolving it, certainly not on the other side of the controversy. But you get closer and closer to that. And there's such partisan bitterness that has developed over time. I think it's worse this year than it's been in recent years. Somebody is going to say, well, damn it, I'm not going to vote for that. I just want to spite the other side. This would be the Republicans in this particular instance. And what it's like when people get angry with each other. They're quite willing to accept serious consequences of their stubbornness.
We are going to continue our conversation. That is Paul Beck, political scientist and professor emeritus at Ohio State, and also with us, Richard Silla, an economist and professor emeritus at the New York University Stern School of Business. We will continue our conversation. We're talking about the debt ceiling, the brinksmanship, the political brinksmanship over the debt ceiling. The House voted yesterday to extend it for like 6 or 7 weeks, meaning they increased it just enough to get the government by for 6 or 7 weeks. But after that, who knows what's going to happen? If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the debt ceiling and the political fight surrounding it in Congress. Still with us, OSU political scientist and professor emeritus Paul Beck, and from the New York University Stern School of Business, economist and professor emeritus Richard Silla. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Paul, Republicans had tried to force Democrats to use the procedure called budget reconciliation to pass an increase in the debt limit they could do that with no help from the GOP. It's a very complicated process. What were the pros and cons of that? I mean, what do they hope to gain by that?
Well, Republicans want the Democrats to take full responsibility for raising the debt ceiling. And one way they could do that is through reconciliation. Now, they also could do it through just a majority vote, except that the Republicans have filibustered, which requires there to be 60 votes to be able to pass this debt ceiling increase. So they're not helping the Democrats to do this. Again, I think this is an example of the kind of polarization that we have and the partisan warfare that it invites.
I'm trying to understand the logic here. Let's say, hypothetically, the Republicans do not vote with the Democrats to raise the debt ceiling and the whole world goes into a tailspin financially. What's the advantage to Republicans, Paul Beck?
Well, I suppose Republicans think that the Democrats are going to be hurt more than the Republicans are if there is some kind of an explosion for failure to raise the debt ceiling. I don't think we know what's going to happen. Their argument would be, well, the Democrats, and they made this argument, by the way, Their argument would be, well, the Democrats are in charge of every, both houses of Congress and the presidency. And so they could do this if they wanted to. And so it's their fault. But of course, what that doesn't take into account is the filibuster in the Senate and a very, very thin margin of Democratic control in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, for that matter. So it's almost a game that's going on where one side hopes the other is going to blink. And that's what brings it all the way up to the to the end and really threatens the debt ceiling will not be increased.
Let's see, Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, good day. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. I'm on Social Security these days, and I just got this month's payment this morning deposited to my account. But these shenanigans have pushed a split-ticket voter, me, squarely, permanently into the blue column. In addition, I'm going to do everything I can to help get out the vote for Tim Ryan for United States Senate. This is absolutely inexcusable. And by the way, I think the Lincoln Project of disaffected Republicans is correct. Biden needs to stop pussyfooting around. He needs to learn how to play hardball. And yeah, that may be escalation and reaction, but to put the good faith and credit of the United States in jeopardy for your personal political gain, Mr. McConnell, is inexcusable. Period.
Thank you, Charlotte. I was wondering, Richard Silla, do you have any thoughts about that, about how this could play out politically? I know you're an economist, not a political scientist, but I'm just kind of curious about what the history of the of these kinds of economic brinksmanship has taught us.
Well, I think if they did it, it would be a bad thing. But, there would be such a reaction. I mean, if they allowed the debt ceiling to take effect and the Treasury could not pay the U.S. bills, there would be such bad effects in financial markets and among Social Security recipients, as we just saw, if they weren't going to get those checks, that, in the first week or so, Congress would realize it had made a terrible mistake and do something to undo the damage that had been done. We saw an example of this in the financial crisis of 2008. It wasn't about the debt ceiling, but after Lehman Brothers failed, the Treasury asked for a lot of authority to manage that crisis, and Congress didn't give it, and the stock market took a big tumble. And so just a few days later, Congress went along with the request from the Treasury to have this expanded authority. So these are politicians, and they don't want things to go to hell. They will make a change. It's better to avoid that. But that is what we might see. I hope
not. Or if it does go to hell, at least make sure that they've got talking points to blame it on the other guy.
Yeah, I think to come back to a point made earlier, the Democrats could do this through reconciliation, and that's what Mitch McConnell wants them to do. I think one of the reasons the Democrats are shy away from that is that the reconciliation process will lead to all kinds of other debates, that's tacked in there. And so the Democrats would like to avoid that, but they could do it, but it's not their optimum strategy.
I would add here that they can only do it if they get unanimity on the part of Democrats in the Senate. And if one Democrat decides, no, I'm not going to vote for reconciliation, if that's part of the package, then their hands are tied and they can't do that.
Charlotte, thanks for that call. Let's see, Martin in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Martin.
Good morning. I think this is an excellent opportunity to do away with two useless institutions. One is the debt ceiling, and the other is the filibuster. The Constitution created the Senate as a break against the impulses of the public, so we've already got that control there. We don't need a supermajority in the Senate to turn things around or protect us from one another. And the other thing is, I think the discussion of the Gephardt Amendment would be an appropriate way to address this issue without resorting to an artificial technique like the debt ceiling, which really doesn't mean anything, and only leads us to these kinds of opportunities for death sentence confrontations that don't take us anywhere from a public policy standpoint or a faith and democracy standpoint. So I think this is an excellent opportunity to do away with two useless appendages.
Well, do you think that Congress can get its act together? I mean, they can't agree on anything these days, Martin. Why this?
Well, I think your previous caller gave some pretty good illustrations about what we as citizens have to do. If we don't like what's happening, we've got to get organized and begin to take care of the situation ourselves, because it's clearly not being addressed by the people that we've charged with that responsibility.
But do you think of it as a Republican or a Democratic problem? I mean, do you see the like Charlotte sees the Republicans at fault here? I mean, is it?
Well, I think in this particular instance, the Republicans are at fault, but by the same token, numbers change around in the future, and it's another group that has the leadership on being ridiculous about how their public policies get worked out. So I think the institution's mechanisms need to be addressed so that we don't invite ourselves into the luxury of playing these kind of games.
All right. Paul Beck?
Well, I think that you know, talking about the filibuster first, that it may well be that the filibuster has been abused over time. It's much easier to filibuster today than it was 20 and 30 years ago, mainly because all you have to do is say, I'm filibustering. You don't have to stand up on the floor of the U.S. Senate and talk and talk and talk and talk. So there are things that could be done to modify the impact or the ease of filibustering. In the the previous two centuries, there was hardly any filibustering that went on. And now it's become a very common thing. But if you step back a bit and think about, okay, why are we at the place we are at right now? There are several things to bear in mind. One is that we have spent more than we've taken in revenue in each year for many, many years. And that, of course, continues to add to the debt. And both parties are responsible for that. The tax cuts that were enacted during the Trump administration never really realized the revenues that the spin of the time said that they would. And of course, there's been an explosion in defense costs that have been, really a Republican thing, but also a lot of Democrats have voted for them as well. So there's certainly that issue. It keeps adding to the debt, and that accumulates over time. There was only a period in the 1990s when we actually were running the government at a surplus, and that pretty quickly dissipated in the early 2000s. Congress doesn't like it. Congress likes to spend money, Democrats and Republicans. They don't like to tax.
Right. I was going to say.
That creates this imbalance that continues to be with it. And then, of course, what's happened in the last year or two with the pandemic and the economic consequences of that has been that there's been a downfall in expected revenue that wouldn't have happened without the pandemic, I think. And because of the difficulties that the pandemic has created, there's been more government expenditure that people in both parties have supported. So that's there as well. And maybe once we get through the pandemic, or at least the worst of it, and the economy rebounds as it seems to be doing, then things will straighten out a bit. Maybe even the debt won't be as high. And now we've been in a fortunate period where the interest rates are fairly low. So it's good for government to borrow money during this time. But if interest rates go up, then it becomes more costly, and that creates a different kind of problem.
Right. And that would happen almost immediately, right, Richard Sulla, that interest rates would go up for the government. But that would filter down to an everyday American, too?
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, interest rates would go up a lot because, that confidence in the prime credit of the United States would go down. So people would say, well, I'm not going to hold U.S. government debt unless I get a better reward for doing it. So I think one of the very quick effects of violating or defaulting on our debt would be that, interest rates would go up. We see this around the world when countries default on their debts. Countries like Argentina, they find it difficult to borrow. And if they can borrow, it's at very high rates. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's really counterproductive to violate the credit of the United States because it's going to end up costing us a lot more. I mean, the debt will still be there. We'll just have to pay a lot more money to service it. That's why I think it's really kind of irresponsible for Congress to play these games.
Let's see. Thanks to Martin in Worthington. And now Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, the main problem is wherever you have Democrats in office, be it local, state, or federal government, it turns into a cesspool. And it's simply the rules of Saul Alinsky that's going on right now. You create inflation that has been done, granted, with the Republicans, but the job of the federal government is national defense and to regulate interstate commerce and to provide infrastructure. Other than that, all these federal welfare programs and everything else should have never been implemented by the federal government. That's why we are like we are, just like Biden's budget right now. We are with a $1 trillion budget that's supposed to go towards infrastructure, then another $2.5 trillion for all these needless, worthless social programs that just take us down the road of socialism that will eventually destroy this country. It is the rules and the laws of Saul Alinsky who were implemented by Hillary Clinton and the rest of the Democrats. And I say why, and to me, it's a great symbol of the jackass to be a part of the Democratic Party.
Paul Beck, as far as who shares the blame for the spending in the United States?
Oh, I think the blame is shared by both parties. Again, if you think of the defense budget, which has gone up and up and up, even in times when we have no conflicts abroad, right now, there's little talk of cutting the defense budget. And so that's certainly something. If the caller is saying we ought to do away with Social Security and Medicare, I think that most Americans, maybe even him, would say, well, no, I don't really want to go that far. And then we need to remember also, going back to the interest on the debt, that about 20% of the money that the federal government spends is to pay off the interest on the debt, to service that debt. And that's a substantial amount of money. The social programs actually are fairly small as a percentage of national expenditures, much smaller than defense, and certainly much smaller than interest on the debt.
You brought up earlier, Richard Cilla, that the increase in the debt, though, has exponentially occurred in the last 40 or 50 years.
Yes, it has. And I think, the previous caller made a point that, the government spending has really risen a great deal. I think that's the outcome of our political process. I mean, in some sense, people have voted for that. Mike, I worry a little bit, that I think about the ratio of our debt to the GDP. And it used to be under 100%. I mean, back in the 1970s, before we went on this borrowing binge, it was maybe 35 to 40%. And now it's up to about 120 some percent. And that's where we were at the end of World War II when we fought wars in Europe and in the Pacific and borrowed a lot of money to do it. And, we won those wars. I mean, that's the great advantage of having a great credit for our country. It's easy to borrow when you get into situations like that. But now in relatively peacetime compared to World War II, we've run our national debt up to 120 some percent of the GDP. And I think if there's any virtue to the debt ceiling, it acts as a sort of speed bump on the road to fiscal irresponsibility, that it makes us pause every now and then and say, are we getting what we want from the government? Is spending all this money, putting it on the credit card? Is it really worth doing that if we're going to have to pay higher taxes down the road or higher interest in the world financial markets? So, that's about the only virtue I see in the debt ceiling, that it makes us every now and then evaluate what the government is doing and whether it's really worthwhile.
Richard Silla, economist and professor emeritus at the New York University Stern School of Business. Thanks so much for your time again. I really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
And Paul Beck, political scientist and professor emeritus at Ohio State. Paul, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you, Anne. Good to meet you, Richard.
Paul. Thanks to everybody else for listening. Thanks for your calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.